You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a leaked draft of an internal UN report makes uncompromising criticism of the UN's weak-kneed response to the brutal concluding months of Sri Lanka's civil war. We'll be asking if the UN will learn anything from this failure in the face of internecine violence that it hasn't learnt from all its others.
If I were Tamil and I listened to this report, I looked at this and I'd lost relatives, I'd feel extremely angry and bitter about the UN and the role it played.
Zurich, according to no less an authority than Monocle magazine, the world's most livable city, announces plans to make itself even more so. We'll hear about Zurich's hopes of doubling its population of cyclists.
Now what we plan is to build a new route network with two type of routes. The one is the so-called main routes, which is meant for the everyday traffic. And the other routes are so-called comfort routes, mostly separated from motorized traffic.
Berlin's long-awaited new Willy Brandt Airport looks set to be even longer awaited. It now seems that some of what they have managed to build will have to be torn down. We'll have the latest on this interminable shambles from our correspondent with the yellowing boarding pass and forlorn expression. And we'll be asking if the London art world's centre of gravity is retreating from the east and returning to less exotic, more venerable postcodes. All of that, more besides, and a tune or two, coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, the world news with Jonathan Wheatley.
European Union foreign ministers who met their Arab counterparts at the Arab League headquarters in Cairo today have praised the Syrian opposition for forging a new coalition. The British Foreign Secretary William Hague said more needs to be done before Britain formally recognised the Syrian National Congress. France agreed with Britain's decision.
Our approach has been to give non-lethal support to the opposition. That is how it stands today. And, of course, to send more humanitarian assistance to the hundreds of thousands of people who have fled over the Syrian border. So we hope they will now implement the agreement in detail and that we will be able to go on to recognize them as the legitimate representatives of the people of Syria.
India's Asian Games gold medal winner Pinky Pramanik has been charged with rape and cheating after medical reports appear to confirm she is actually a man. Pramanik won a gold medal in the women's 4x400 metres relay at the 2006 Asian Games, but was arrested on the 14th of June this year following a complaint lodged by a woman, Anamika Acharya, who said she was the live-in partner of the athlete. In her complaint, she levelled rape charges against Pramanik. Santoymoy Boise is the public prosecutor.
I just come into the conclusion that Pinky is male. A medical board consisting of 7 members have come to conclusion that Pinky is male and Pinky is capable to commit intercourse with a female.
The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton reiterated America's commitment to the Asia-Pacific region today in a speech at the University of Western Australia. Clinton and the Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard reiterated their country's strong relationship.
It is no surprise that foreign investment is soaring, including more than $100 billion from the United States, because increasingly these waters are at the heart of the global economy and a key focus of America's expanding engagement in the region.
The United States is the oldest of allies. We've been in an alliance for more than 60 years, and we are good mates at every level. We share a strategic partnership and defence relationship.
Greece has commissioned a seismic survey company to explore for hydrocarbon deposits in the Ionian and Mediterranean Sea, hoping for some newfound wealth from possible natural gas reserves as it continues to suffer from its debt crisis. The research vessel Nordic Explorer, run by Petroleum Geophysical, or PGS, set off on Sunday to conduct geophysical surveys south of the island of Crete. Jason Robinson is in charge of business development for PGS.
What the seismic will do is identify where the traps are. So we can see the formation of rocks and identify where is the best place to drill. And so PGS doesn't do that. We execute the seismic, and then oil and gas exploration companies come in and they will bid for the license blocks, and they'll do the exploration and the drilling using the seismic data to guide where they will drill.
And finally, a New Zealand court has ordered an anti-monarchist to stay away from Britain's Prince Charles and his wife Camilla after he was charged with planning to throw horse manure at the visiting royal couple. Sam Brakhanov, a 76-year-old with a history of protest against the British royal family, pleaded not guilty to preparing to commit a crime a day after he was arrested in Auckland. The royal couple had not yet arrived in New Zealand's larger city. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Just their way of shaking hands in New Zealand, really. Thank you, Jonathan. It's 6 minutes past the hour. That's 6 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. Events mark a grave failure of the UN to adequately respond, to the detriment of hundreds of thousands of civilians. It's a line from a leaked draft of an internal report investigating the UN's role during the concluding months of Sri Lanka's 26-year civil war, which ended in 2009. As many as 40,000 people died during the brutal last 5 months of the conflict, and hundreds of thousands were displaced. Sadly, however, the key findings of this report could have been cut and pasted from any assessment of the UN's role in several other recent conflicts, most notably Rwanda and Bosnia, during which civilians died en masse with little in the way of deterrent from anybody wearing a blue helmet. Earlier, I spoke to Frances Harrison, former BBC correspondent in Sri Lanka and author of Still Counting the Dead, a book chronicling the vicious final months of the war between Sri Lanka's government and the Tamil Tigers. I began by asking Frances to explain the UN's theoretical role in Sri Lanka.
Well, in theory, it should have upheld its mandate and protected human rights issues, protected civilians who were being slaughtered in the thousands. Of course, it had a mandate to deliver humanitarian assistance, but also, of course, to protect.
What were the realistic options for doing that, though? Because there wasn't a peacekeeping force as such, was there?
There was no peacekeeping force, it's true. I think you have to look at what went wrong in Sri Lanka with the UN. And it really started in September 2008 when the government ordered them out of what were rebel areas, just as the war escalated. And the UN didn't really protest much. It just pulled out all its international staff, left its Tamil staff and their families, it has to be said, whom the Tigers wouldn't allow out. And then thought, OK, well, we can send in food in convoys going by land. And then by the time they got to the 11th food convoy in the beginning of at the end of January in 2009, they had two expatriate staff on that convoy who were lucky to get out alive. They witnessed the most appalling shelling of civilian areas. Literally, they were bunkered, in a sort of makeshift bunker as shells were landing every few seconds around them, 10, 30 metres away. And when they got up in the morning and looked out, they found the people they'd spoken to the night before, the bits of their bodies splattered everywhere, babies' heads in trees, all the food burnt up. So, they were independent witnesses who had first-hand testimony of war crimes. And they were convinced, because there was a military man amongst them, that the shells came from the government side. And they came out, and really what the UN should have done is put them all over BBC and CNN and made a big, noise about what happened. But it didn't do that. And this was a pattern that went on throughout those 5 months of war, where the UN had really crucial information about casualty data and just sat on it.
When you talk about the government ordering the UN out of those tiger-held areas, of course, talking about the Sri Lankan government. Does the UN, what realistic option does the UN have in a position like that of just saying, no, we're not going?
I think it would have been difficult to say, no, we're not going, but they could have tried to negotiate that they would have moved further inland away from the front line towards the coast where all the civilians did go anyway. And they could have really protested a little bit louder. They kind of rolled over. I think that's the sort of the feeling about it. They just were concerned about being declared persona non grata themselves, about having access, although they lost all access really to people. And they had a history in Sri Lanka of being quite passive.
It's not the first time, of course, in recent years that the UN has rolled over in the face of violence of this sort. Was the situation here, I mean, I know there was the absence of peacekeepers, but was there a similar dynamic here to what was we saw in Bosnia and Rwanda, where at the first sight of meaningful trouble, the UN acted to protect its own people and left the locals to their own devices?
Well, of course, in this war, the UN didn't protect its own local staff, and many of them are still in grave danger and not being supported by the UN. I personally know people who, Sri Lankan Tamils who work for the UN, who've been completely abandoned, even today. But the draft report that's been leaked does talk about Rwanda, and it talks about lessons that should have been learnt from Rwanda that would have been relevant to Sri Lanka. Clearly, they weren't learnt. I think, of course, the difference between Rwanda and Yugoslavia and what we see in Sri Lanka is that Sri Lanka was post 9/11. It was in the world of global war on terror, and they'd managed to designate the Sri Lankan government, the Tigers, have them proscribed internationally as a terrorist group. And I think that really coloured the reporting of the war and the last phase of the conflict from the UN and from the media, of course, too. But the UN set the tone for everybody else, and they almost told the diplomats or the senior officials in New York what they wanted to hear, which was that the Tigers were the baddies, they were the terrorists, and the government, therefore, were fighting a legitimate war on terror. And in reality, it was quite different in the sense, I'm not saying that the Tigers weren't doing, appalling things too, but the majority of killings, according to this internal review, the UN knew that they were being perpetrated by government shelling. And yet they never said that to diplomats, even in briefings. They withheld that information. So as someone who's sat there and listened to survivors of this war, weep and shake and whisper these horrific stories of what they went through, to think that there was that information available during the height of the fighting that could, if it had been made public, have impacted the outcome of the war, that the world might have taken a bit more notice and might have tried to intervene or pressure the Sri Lankan government not to to kill people in that way, is horrific. I mean, if I were Tamil and I listened to this report, I looked at this and I'd lost relatives, I'd feel extremely angry and bitter about the UN and the role it played.
Wouldn't the UN's response to that be that it really can only do what it's permitted to do by its member states?
Of course, it needs the backing of its member states. And in terms of UN Security Council action, there wasn't any backing. There was no meeting at all on Sri Lanka during 2009. And even afterwards, the Human Rights Council initially didn't take action, in fact, congratulated the Sri Lankan government on winning. So, yes, it needs that international backing. But it's a little bit more complex. I think if the UN team in Sri Lanka had crucial information about the extent, the scale of casualties, and we're talking about very large-scale killing of civilians, of women and children, that they knew about. To give you an example, they had a long-distance team that phoned up the war zone because they had no access and talked to various reliable people, priests, doctors, school teachers, and their own NGO staff, their own UN employees, and triangulated reports of casualties. So for every name, they had to have three independent sources to corroborate that someone had been killed or injured. And so they had a statistic that they gathered during those months, and they never made that public. And then they did make one mild figure kind of public, and then they denied it or rolled back on it or said it wasn't reliable. And yet, really, when you look at death tolls or casualty lists from wars, they're not very rigorously maintained on the whole. And we quote figures for Afghanistan or Syria, and they're not necessarily nearly as rigorously corroborated as that UN figure that they didn't want to make public or scream and shout about, if you like. And we know now also from this report that the figure in terms of unconfirmed reports of deaths that they received was incredibly high. It was about 18,000 killed and 37,000 injured. And they couldn't corroborate more than about half of that. But if they'd said during the course of the war, well, we know there are, we've heard uncorroborated reports, unconfirmed reports of 50,000 casualties, I think the world would have sat up and listened.
Or not, as the case may be. That was, for 26 years, an incredibly underreported war, as you know better than most people, as someone who tried to report it. It was one of those ones, like those huge-scale wars in Africa often are, that just dropped completely off the radar. The one thing that leapt out at me there in what you just said, which struck me as absolutely staggering, was that there wasn't even a meeting.
There was no meeting of the UN Security Council. There was one informal meeting in the basement of the UN building throughout the whole period. I mean, it's odd because when you look at what was going on in Gaza in 2009, there was a huge amount of attention. And yet how many people died in the Gaza offensive? Maybe 1,500 or so. And yet you're talking, according to the UN documents themselves, possibly, I mean, they say reports of 40,000 credible being killed, credible in 2009 and possibly 70,000. So that's actually, in a short space of 5 months, extremely intense in terms of killing. I mean, that's makes it one of the worst atrocities for decades, actually. And yet it didn't get reported. And that was partly, I think, the UN's doing.
Do you think this report, or what we know of this report, this is, of course, a leaked draft, which the UN has so far not commented on, is likely to change anything, given the UN's sort of fairly solid record of failure in such circumstances over the last 20 years or so?
Whether the systemic failure this report talks about will be addressed properly in the future, it's really hard to say. But I think there's a couple of other things that need to change as a result. I mean, there are individuals named, really. I mean, their posts are referred to, so you know who they are in this report. And I think, you know, some serious questions need to be asked about their responsibility for what happened. And then I think in a broader sense, what the UN needs to do now in order to save its credibility, really, in Sri Lanka on this war, is call for an independent international investigation into all these allegations of war crimes committed by both sides. And that's what a panel of experts Ban Ki-moon commissioned to write him a report said that he should do last year, and he hasn't done it. And it's clear from this report that his own legal affairs department said he did have the power to do that, and he really needs to take action now to show the UN wants to clear up its record on Sri Lanka and investigate these war crimes.
That was Frances Harrison, author of Still Counting the Dead, speaking to me earlier. You're listening to Midori House. We continue with Zurich's ambitious plans to boost cycling in the world's most livable city after this.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we head down under for an Australian special. We say g'day to a host of the names and characters putting the Antipodean continent on the global design circuit. From website mogul Lucy Feagans to Sydney designer retailers Koskela. Brandon Guillen, director of Good Design Australia, tells us what Australian design might give to the rest of the world too.
Lower volume, high quality products, high technology content. We've really started to differentiate the products that we have here in the medical and scientific field.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
AS 1818 in London, you're listening to Midori House. It's quite difficult to find cities that don't have a positive attitude towards cycling, officially at least. Citizens commuting on velocipedes stay fitter, cause no pollution and take up less road space. However, even the most cycle-friendly cities often find their cycle traffic stagnating. Zurich is one of these places. But now the Swiss city, dubbed the world's most livable by Monocle, has launched an ambitious project which is aiming to double the number of bicycle trips. The method certainly sound inventive, with such things as comfort routes and bicycle carpets, whatever they may be, among the new initiatives. But will they work? Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards spoke earlier to Urs Walter, the bicycle coordinator of Zurich. Urs began by explaining the master plan's broad objectives.
Well, the objectives are clearly to get more people on the bikes and also reduce the risk of accidents, because we had an increase of accidents the last few years, so there was something that had to be done. And especially we also want to have additional groups of cyclists to use the bike more often, especially also children and adolescents. We have quite a decrease of the use of bicycles of children and adolescents from the last few years, so that's something we want to change the next years.
Now, it's very interesting. I've read that there's been something of a stagnation in terms of the amount of bicycle traffic there's been since the year 2000. I wonder, what's behind that? Is it because people are scared of cars and traffic? Is that the main problem?
Actually, we don't know the real reason why there's a stagnation. We have some surveys that indeed say that they feel unsure on the bikes in traffic, and they judge cycling infrastructure to be unsafe and uncomfortable. So this is certainly a reason, but it doesn't explain fully why we had really a stagnation of bicycle use. We also have a lot of frequent countings of the bicycle traffic, and there we have an increase over the last few years. So it doesn't really match the results we have, but the official modal split tells us that we had a stagnation.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the actual master plan itself. What are some of the ideas that you've come up with? Because I know there's things called comfort routes. You've also got bicycle carpets, which sound very mysterious. Tell us about what the actual techniques you're going to be using.
Well, it's not really mysterious. We have a new approach with really different target groups. We have the experienced cyclists. They don't really need measures at all. They do quite well in traffic, in city traffic. But then we also have the not-so-used cyclists who are also a bit afraid to cycle in the traffic. And for these cyclists, we want to build an infrastructure. So now what we plan is to build a new route network with two type of routes. The one is the so-called main routes, which is meant for the everyday traffic, which should be comfortable, fast, and so on. And the other routes are so-called comfort routes. And these are really meant as a kind of a bicycle carpet, we call them, and they allow to traverse the city in a relaxed and pleasurable way. So you can also use them with a family, with children, mostly separated from motorized traffic. So these are the two different type of routes we want to implement in the next years.
I must say that the bicycle carpet does sound very comfortable, but I just wondered, have you looked to other cities for inspiration? Because obviously a lot of different cities in Europe and around the world have different kinds of bike lanes, traffic management systems. Have you taken your inspiration from anywhere in particular for Zurich?
Yes, of course. We always look what's going on all over Europe. And also these comfort routes are a bit inspired by the bicycle highways. They pop up all over Europe, but in a small city like Zurich, you don't really have the place to build kind of bicycle highways, but we want to have an infrastructure for, as I said, like families and children travel through the city. So they were kind of inspired by bicycle highways that are implemented in Holland and in Germany and in Scandinavia as well.
I wanted to ask you about, I mean, a lot of cities here in London, we've had over the last few years the success of our Boris bikes, as they're known, the bicycle hire scheme. Is there a place in the master plan for bicycle hire? And we've seen it again very successfully in Paris with the Vélo Libre. Is there something that is going to play a part of this in Zurich?
Yes, it is. It's one of the measures of the master plan as well. We are planning to implement a bike sharing system within the next few years. We won't call them Boris bikes, but we find a name for them.
And just briefly, I mean, I was going to sort of close by asking you about the difficulties you face, because obviously cities around the world, their urban planners want to try and get people on bikes and out of their cars and keep people safe, especially families and children.
Yeah.
But there often seems to be problems, some resistance from the car lobby, from, you know, big transport, people who move large amounts of freight, that sort of thing. Are you confident that this is really going to make a difference?
Well, I really hope so, that the master plan is going to make a difference. Of course, we will have some objection of the car lobby as well. All these bicycle routes, you need some place to implement them, and this place has to come from somewhere. And of course, this somewhere means also parking places and lanes for cars. So this will provoke some objection, I think. And Zurich is a city with quite narrow street spaces. So we don't really have a lot of road surface to play with. And we have a very strong public transport, which means a lot of people just use trams and buses in Zurich. And they won't use a bicycle very easily.
And there's one final thing that's occurred to me. Obviously, Monocle, we're very interested in quality of life in cities around the world. Zurich obviously always rates very, very highly. Are you confident that this kind of measure will keep the city right at the cutting edge of cities worldwide in terms of how great they are to live in?
Well, that's really one of the main goals. We consider bicycle traffic or the possibility to bike in a city as a very important thing for the quality of life. So if you look all over the world, the most cities that have a high standard in quality of life, they have also good infrastructure for pedestrians and bicycles, like Copenhagen, like Vienna, Barcelona, or Vancouver, which is also top ranked.
And that was Urs Walter, Zurich's bicycle coordinator, talking earlier to Monocle's Tom Edwards. Before the news at the bottom of the hour, some music chosen in honour of our previous story. This is Bicycle by Memory Tapes. That was Bicycle by Memory Tapes. In the next half hour of Midori House, we will ask the always reasonable question, why would you shrink wrap a cucumber? But first, here's the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thank you very much. European Union foreign ministers who met their Arab counterparts at the Arab League headquarters in Cairo today have praised the Syrian opposition for forging a new coalition, although the British Foreign Secretary said more needs to be done before Britain formally recognised them. India's Asian Games gold medal winner Pinky Pramanik has been charged with rape and cheating after medical reports appeared to confirm she is actually a man. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton reiterated America's commitment to the Asia-Pacific region today in a speech at the University of Western Australia in Perth. Clinton and the Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard reiterated their country's strong relationship. And Greece has commissioned a seismic survey company to explore for hydrocarbon deposits in the Ionian and Mediterranean Sea, hoping for some newfound wealth from possible natural gas reserves as it continues to suffer from its debt crisis. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. This correspondent first became convinced of the imminent and irreversible collapse of Western civilization when encountering, at a motorway service station, a tray full of oranges, each encased in a cardboard wrapper bearing the words Citrus Snack Solution. There is, of course, enough wrong with this to keep us here all night, days even, but the most egregious affront, at least as I saw it, was the very idea of packing oranges at all, oranges having already been packaged and indeed branded beyond improvement by evolution and by mankind's unwillingness to think of a less obvious name for something orange. However, excruciating though it is to have to admit it, I may not have been entirely correct to take such umbrage. Joining me now to help me explain why is Laurel Miller, co-author of Why Shrink Wrap a Cucumber. Good evening, Laurel.
Good evening.
First, the obvious question, or to put your question straight back to you, why would you shrink wrap a cucumber?
Well, I suppose the humble cucumber has been rather a focus of environmental awareness. Why would you shrink wrap it? Well, because it would prolong the life of the cucumber. It would actually extend its life from around 3 days to 12 to 14 days. Thus, it would stop deliveries in the meantime. So within that 12 to 14 days, ordinarily you might have 4 or 5 deliveries using fuel, obviously, and it would also maintain the freshness of that cucumber. And, you know, you can go into several of the supermarkets. In some you can see cucumbers that are unwrapped, you have shrink-wrapped cucumbers, and just do a little test yourself. Go in, pick up a cucumber, wave it about in the air, and just see, you know, how much fresher, how much more rigid the cucumber is that's actually shrink-wrapped. So do that test tomorrow, I urge you.
Well, I'm going to take your word for it rather than wave cucumbers around in the aisle at Tesco's, where in the part of London I live in, that could get you shot. So is it the case then that there actually often is a good reason for the packaging on foods? Or that even that there usually is a good reason for the packaging even of fresh fruit and vegetables?
Well, there is sometimes a good reason, and environmental issues are always a balancing act. You have to take into consideration, you know, how long did it take for that piece of fruit to actually travel to the supermarket. It's a very complex area, and to make improvements, you have to really make judgments and logical judgments about what's happening. I mean, you get the ridiculous. You get recently in Japan, they were peeling bananas, putting 3 in a tray and putting shrink wrap wrap over it. And obviously a banana is a perfect piece of design, you know. As a designer myself, if I designed the banana skin, you know, I would be extremely pleased with myself.
So, difficult to improve upon, certainly.
Exactly, but, you know, you have to always try and look beyond what you're being told, I think. You know, just think, well, how far has this orange actually travelled? You know, and as an environmental designer myself, I have to make those kind of judgments in order to make improvements.
Well, the subtitle of your book, Why Shrink Wrap a Cucumber, is The Complete Guide to Environmental Packaging. And in terms of the examples of environmental packaging that you write about and illustrate in the book, what are your particular ideas, I guess, of benchmarks in the field, like really good examples of environmental packaging?
I think, well, the way to judge packaging, I suppose, is it overpackaged? So if I went into a supermarket tomorrow and I went round the shelves, I could probably find what I would call envirocrime on every shelf, you know, where actually that piece of hardware, product, food, whatever it might be, is actually overpackaged. And that, you know, actually in this day and age shouldn't be happening. So if you can reduce materials and if you can use materials intelligently to hold the product, to protect the product, and bear in mind that packaging has to fulfill a huge amount of constraints, you know. It has to protect, you know, whatever product it is has to form a protective function. It has to sell that product, has to market that product. It actually has to talk to the consumer off the shelf in many cases, because even as an environmental packaging designer, I want to sell product because I have to keep people in work. I have to fuel the economy, you know, we're in a recession. You can't just say, go and put everything in brown paper bags, because actually that's not the solution. You have to take every product and evaluate, you know, actually how should that be packaged. So reuse is a fabulous thing for packaging. If you can actually design a piece of packaging which has a reuse, you eliminate that need to throw that piece of packaging away. So, you know, it's kind of horses for courses, I'm afraid, you know, and there isn't a simple answer. But I just think people need to stop allowing packaging to evolve without making kind of intelligent judgments about, you know, why is it actually packaged like that in the first place.
What tends to cause overpackaging like that? Is it just thoughtlessness or carelessness, or are there commercial reasons for it? Does some overpackaging actually sell the product?
Well, I don't believe that there is any valid reason to overpackage anything in this day and age. I don't actually think that there would be a valid reason for that. I mean, in gift packaging, for example, you could use a little bit more material, but you could offer an after use. So you could, for example, put the products in a wet bag, you know, so then the consumer has something usable to use beyond buying that piece of packaging. So I actually think that there isn't really an excuse for over packaging, and also packaging that you can't open effectively and easily.
Laurel Miller, co-author of Why Shrink Wrap a Cucumber, The Complete Guide to Environmental Packaging. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this to warn you not to book flights to Berlin Brandenburg just yet.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick-and-span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero-emission zealots. For a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
Just gone 18:39 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. There's not much good to say about Berlin's long-awaited new international airport, except that the saga to date has done a great deal to dilute the popular stereotype of Germany as a redoubt of ironclad efficiency. Originally intended to open in October 2011, the project has become the most wretched fiasco to have plagued Berlin since Roger Waters performed The Wall on Potsdamer Platz. Another opening date in June this year came and went, and another projected ribbon cutting in March 2013 has also been postponed. Now it seems that the currently planned first takeoff in October 2013, a full 2 years behind schedule, may also have been optimistic. Problems with the fire safety system may now prompt yet another delay. Joining me now is Monocle's woman in Berlin, Kimberly Bradley. Kimberly, what is the latest problem exactly?
More stuff having to do with the fire protection system, which includes a faulty sprinkler system. All the valves that are meant to reduce smoke are questionably installed at the moment. There's still a lot of questions going on, and there are talks that are happening this whole week. But last week it became clear after appraisers took a look at the existing structure that there were these additional fire safety problems.
Is it true that they may actually have to tear down some of what they have managed to build?
They're saying that, but they are not sure yet. It would be portions of the existing terminal, not the whole thing.
This has been the most extraordinary shambles, and as I was saying, approximately the last thing that we've come to expect from Germans and Germany. Is there one single reason for it, or have just a whole bunch of things gone wrong?
I think it's a whole bunch of things. I think the original, not the very original opening date, but the June 2012 opening date was optimistic, and they had discovered some problems early in the spring that they didn't want to make public right away, which delayed the announcement of the delay until May, which surprised everybody. I think they were probably rushing the construction. I think they underestimated the traffic that we'd be going through. I think that they may have been, this is a conjecture, may have been trying to save some money. I don't think I'll say anything else.
But how have Germany's airlines, especially Lufthansa and Air Berlin, been reacting to this latest announcement?
The latest one is interesting. Lufthansa is staying quiet and hoping that the October 2013 date will be held to. Air Berlin is not very happy. Actually, last week, they made an announcement that they would be suing the airport company for damages. Air Berlin had not been doing well anyway and had added many, many flights to their schedule, hoping that it would open this year. And they feel like they've taken additional losses. The airport company is saying that these losses, you know, that they are not liable for them. But Air Berlin is suffering and not happy.
And in terms of Berlin's municipal politics, is this having an effect on the mayor, Klaus Wowereit, or other Berlin politicians?
Not yet. And this was a question that actually came up in an article in the Berliner Morgenpost, one of the local dailies. People aren't happy about it, but it seems very unlikely that he would be voted out for this reason. The opposing party is in a coalition with the SPD. There's no really possible successor from within his own party. I don't think he's the shining, sunny boy he was a couple of years ago, though.
And, I mean, has he talked about, or has anybody talked about, trying to take charge of this and trying to actually get this thing organized?
Actually, the current technical director was the guy that was supposed to do this. His name is Horst Ammann, and he came in on August 1st. And the one big criticism that's been made public is that he waited until the end of October to have the appraisals submitted. He could have probably done that a little bit faster. But a lot of this depends on what he comes up with as a solution in the next few days.
And how is it playing with Berliners in general? Is there much anger, or are people more or less resigned to it, or do they take the view they've got an airport which more or less works anyway, so it's not that big a deal?
We roll our eyes a little bit at this point. I was just out with another journalist. He's like, oh, the airport. Okay. I think a lot of us actually really like Tegel because it's so easy to come into and out of, and we'll be sad to see it go.
We're used to waiting for things at this point.
Kimberly Bradley in Berlin, thank you. I dare say, for some reason, we'll be talking about this again one day soon. You're listening to Midori House, and we will continue shortly to find out why so many London galleries are moving back from East London to where they were 20 years ago, Mayfair.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monaco 24。Orlando,
Dubai, Monaco 24。Fra
London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando,
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
London.
This is Monaco 24.
1845 in London, you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. A defining phenomenon of London's last decade has been the almost wholesale relocation of its art world to the once all but derelict neighbourhoods to the eastern fringe of the financial district. To walk these almost obnoxiously fashionable streets now, you'd never guess that a decade ago there was nothing between Old Street and Bethnal Green but one Mexican restaurant, several dozen handbag wholesalers and three pubs full of men in golf shirts with a Union Jack tattooed on their hairless heads. However, London's traditional art heartlands appear to be staging a comeback, a renaissance even. The White Cube Gallery is abandoning Hoxton Square to focus on St. James. Four major New York galleries have recently descended upon Mayfair. And to explain why, I'm joined now in the studio by David Rosen, senior partner at Pilcher Hirschman, who help galleries find new premises in London. David, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
How much business did this flowering of East London take away from Mayfair?
Quite a lot, if you think about it. People like Victoria Miro left Cork Street. She's now coming back to Mayfair. Cagosian pretty much left the West End, went over to King's Cross, and numerous other galleries made that migration east. Although now, as we've seen, they're all starting to come back into the West End simply because it's all about Sotheby's, Christie's, the Connaught, Claridge's, and all the exclusive restaurants, Ciccone's, Cipriani, Scott's, etc. That's where the money travels around. That's why all the heavyweight art galleries are based around Mayfair and up to a certain point, St. James's.
Does East London now start to feel a bit like a deflating balloon, a sort of area whose time has passed, or is it just that the two districts have settled into different roles in the art world?
Yeah, up to a point that's true, although what you're now getting is a migration from the East End over to Fitzrovia, which is an emerging location where the galleries who don't want to be in Mayfair or St. James's have had enough of being in the East End. They seem to be settling around that side of town. And there's numerous galleries that you'd find around East Castle Street, Berners Street, and Great Portland Street that have emerged.
Does this suggest that, as is very often the case, all these cutting-edge revolutionaries really desired nothing so much as to be part of the establishment?
I don't know about that, because if you look at the shows that they and their programmes, I wouldn't call it establishment. When you look at what Houser and Worth do and the kind of controversial shows they put on, or Sadie Coles with John Curran and other projects like that, I mean, you know, I wouldn't exactly say that, but London is a very fickle city and the money doesn't really travel around, perhaps in the way that it does in New York. So therefore, it just has to make itself more accessible. And if accessibility means being within walking distance to the Sotheby's, Christie's and the top hotels, Claridge's and Connaught, then so be it. That's where the action is. And look at Phillips de Bury.
So when you're helping galleries find premises in London, what are you looking for apart from the location in London? What do you look for in a space?
The most important thing is volume, cubic capacity. 4 meter high ceilings or as close as possible to that. Volume, light, character. The light can be closed out for hanging space. If you take the new Blaine Southern Gallery, where they've taken the whole of the Hanover Street elevation, blocked it out. But predominantly it's about volume.
And how easy is it to find places of that scale in central London?
For most people, pretty difficult. For me, I just pound the streets, keep going till I come up with the, well, in a sense, it's kind of making people's spatial dreams a reality. I remember with Iwan Wirth, he wanted Chelsea, New York in the middle of Mayfair a few years ago. 23 Savile Row, he's got it. David Zwirner, he wanted a kind of really elegant townhouse in Mayfair, 24 Grafton Street.
And are the property owners generally happy to have art galleries as tenants?
They didn't quite get it at first. They just thought the art world was a bit murky and a bit complicated. They were quite happy to have, you know, a hedge fund in their buildings or, you know, a conventional showroom user or a retailer. But I've gone to a great, you know, lengths to explain to them the kind of culture of what they're getting and the commerciality. So they are now getting really amazing people occupying buildings that set the tone for the rest of the development above.
I mean, I lived in East London during the initial late 90s, early 2000s, when that whole period became absolutely transformed beyond recognition. And obviously a big part of the reason for people moving to that part of London, in fact, the reason I moved to that part of London, was that property was relatively cheap. Is part of this movement back to Mayfair because the prices have equalised a bit? That East London's not the bargain it once was?
No, not at all. I mean, East London, comparatively, is phenomenally cheaper. It's just, I think that these businesses, these art gallery businesses, have realised that the business side of it is, where I've said before, where people want to be. And they don't really make, beyond going to an opening or a one-off show, they don't really want to travel around.
And is the people approaching you to find spaces in the traditional heartlands of Mayfair, is it the complete spectrum of the art world? Is that where the sort of the cutting edge places are looking to set up now as well?
Absolutely. It could be, you know, real East End galleries that are saying, look, we'll take a smaller space, but we want to be in Mayfair or Fitzrovia. It could be as large as people like Phillips Depuri with the backing of Mercury, where they're going into this massive building that we just got for them on the corner of Berkeley Square and Davis Street. You know, I mean, it's just an array of people who now want to be in the West End pretty much as long as there's a W1 postal code. That's why Fitzrovia is working as well when you look at who's around there.
And aside from the traditional West End and I guess the more recently traditional East End, are there other pockets of London which are starting to have galleries take an interest in them?
Well, as I said before, Fitzrovia is really emerging as a serious alternate West End location.
And Victoria as well, apparently.
No, Victoria not so much. Victoria, what that's captured is the imagination of the luxury brand retailers for their headquarters, like Burberry, Jimmy Choo, Tom Ford. Phillips Depuri, who were in Howick Place, in the old post office depot, they're going to be moving out of that because the action is not in Victoria for their world. They are coming into Berkeley Square so that they can go kind of head-to-head with the likes of Sotheby's, Christie's, and in a sense, they're going to put them on their mettle because no one will have a location as hot as Berkeley Square and Davis Street.
And just finally, what's the next big opening that you're really excited about?
Well, the most recent one, which I thought was phenomenal, was the David Zwirner opening of Grafton Street with a Luke Timmons show. And I would imagine the next exciting show will be Blaine Southern's next show in Hanover Square.
David Rosen, Senior Partner at Pilcher Hirschman, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. This is Saint Etienne. That was my former Melody Maker colleague, Rocking Bob Stanley, and St Etienne with Hug My Soul. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next after the news is this week's Australia special episode of Section D, wherein Hugo MacDonald will be chatting to architects, designers and writers down under to discover what's happening in the Australian design industry.
People really enjoy the story as well. When you talk to them about the product and how it started, where it came from, the idea, how we got to this point, how we've changed it or had to change it, and to the finished product.
3 hours from now, at 2200 hours here in London, me and Emma Nelson will be back for the Monocle Daily. Louise Beale will be hosting Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Until then, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.